Let's go ahead and let's take out our Bibles and let's open up to Isaiah chapter 7. Isaiah chapter 7, as we walk through this Advent sermon series on the prophet Isaiah. The page is 669 in your pew Bible if you don't have your Bible with you. But Isaiah chapter 7, page 669, that text, the Old Testament text from Isaiah 7 that we read just a few short moments ago, was maybe a little bit confusing, and there's some historical context that we got to take a look at so that these words make sense to us a little better. The first commandment is,
"You shall have no other gods."
Thank you. The first commandment, "You shall have no other gods," which means we should fear, love, and trust in God above all things. You see, God is the center of everything. God alone is worthy, and He rightfully demands and expects our praise and our worship because He's worthy. He's at the center of everything. Now, all of us today have in some way or another brought a rival to worship with us. All of us, to some extent or another, have brought with us false gods to worship. They may not be observable to us or to others, but they're safely tucked away. They're concealed so that nobody can see them. False gods that are rivals to the full and true worship of the one true God. This is whatever you fear, or whoever you fear, whatever you love, or whoever you love, or whatever whoever you trust more than the one true God. That is what competes for the rightful worship of God alone. Sometimes these idols are crass. I mean, they're things that we'd be embarrassed to share with anybody else. Your idol, for example, might be an overindulgence in food, or it might be an addiction to a substance, or it might be a website that you visit on the computer late at night. But then again, those idols might be something that are more acceptable in our modern culture. For example, you might be addicted to money. You might fear, love, and trust in your bank account more than the one true God, and that is acceptable in our culture. Or you might fear, love, and trust your work or your success or what other people think about you or just your own personal well-being at the expense of the fear, love, and trust of the one true God. Now, I anticipate that you maybe say, "I don't have any false gods in my life. I mean, really, I do love God more than anything." But it's a mark of spiritual maturity that you would know what your false gods are that compete for God's worship, and that you would know them, be able to point them out and resist them and say, "No, I know that that competes with my worship for God." See, some of us are idolaters in recovery. We come to meetings together and we say, "I am an idolater. And I need help." And as we kneel down for confession in our worship service, that's exactly what we do. We confess our idols and we say, "God, give us clean hands and give us pure hearts, that we would love you alone, first and foremost." Some of us, though, very well may be idolaters in denial. We haven't really had an intervention, right? We haven't really seen the gravity and the weight of our problem, that we really do fear, love, and trust in other things and other people more than God. And that's a very serious matter because God is worthy of our full fear, love, and trust. John Oswalt, a commentator on the book of Isaiah, says, "Whatever we trust in place of God, whatever you trust in place of God, eventually will turn and devour you." We see this clearly in the actions of King Ahaz in our text in Isaiah chapter 7. Once again, John Oswalt says, "Whatever we trust in place of God will eventually turn and devour us." Now, it might not be immediately seen. You might think, "I feel really great. I feel fine. I mean, yeah, there's other stuff that has my affections more than God, but I feel like life is going pretty good." But we can be devoured from the inside out. That our heart, which is called to be a temple of the living God, would become more and more and more and more occupied by other things that we fear, love, and trust to the point where we're just an empty shell. Religion on the outside, no life on the inside. We see this in the actions of Ahaz in chapter 7 of Isaiah, but we also see that into the mess of human idolatry, God sends the solution. God sends Emmanuel, God with us. Let's look at chapter 7, the first verse. It says, when Ahaz, son of Jotham, the son of Uzziah, was king of Judah, King Rezin of Aram and Pekah, son of Remaliah, king of Israel, marched up to fight against Jerusalem, but they could not overpower it. Now the house of David was told, Aram has allied itself with Ephraim. So the hearts of Ahaz and his people were shaken as the trees of the forest are shaken by the wind. I have a map here that I want to look at here for a moment. I did not draw this. This is way beyond my artistic abilities. A church in Burlington, Vermont had posted this. It's a nice picture of the political situation going on in Isaiah chapter 7. What you got here is you got Judah in the south, King Ahaz, to whom the prophet Isaiah speaks, also called the House of David because Ahaz was of the line of David and Solomon, etc. And the capital is Jerusalem. To the north of Judah and Jerusalem is Israel. Remember that after King Solomon, the kingdom of Israel was torn into two. You had Israel in the north, and then you had Judah in the south. And then you also, so you have Israel here with the capital Samaria, also called Ephraim, King Pekah, the son of Remaliah. And then also you have this other nation, Syria, Damascus, also called Aram, with King Rezin on the throne. So what happens is these two nations are very scared of this other nation, Assyria, which was like the powerhouse. This was like the hungry cat that prowled around the ancient Near East looking for its next meal. And these other nations were like little tiny mice just cowering in its shadow. And so these two nations, Israel and Syria, they say, we need to make a coalition against Assyria to protect ourselves. And so we're going to try to force Ahaz and Judah into a coalition with us. These three little mice up against this big hungry cat. Now Ahaz says, you know, I don't think this is a very good idea. You know why? Because Assyria is a very, very big animal. It's gobbled up all the other nations around me. I don't think it's a good idea to try to join forces with these two little mice and go against a big hungry cat. Now, that's where we get to here in verse 2. That's why Ahaz's heart was troubled, because the two nations to the north of him, Syria and Israel, were joining forces to try to force Ahaz into this coalition. So in the midst of this, the prophet Isaiah speaks. Look at verse 3. Then the Lord said to Isaiah, go out, you and your son, Shear-Jashub, to meet Ahaz at the end of the aqueduct of the upper pool, on the road to the washerman's field. Say to him, be careful, keep calm, and don't be afraid. Do not lose heart because of these two smoldering stubs of firewood, Israel and Syria to the north. So what Isaiah is doing is he's reminding King Ahaz of the history of God's people. God's people have never needed anything more than Emmanuel, God with us. When God's people were in slavery in Egypt, they didn't need another nation to come in and bail them out. What they needed was Emmanuel, God with us. And God did come to them and visit them through Moses and brought them out of Egypt. And as they walked through the wilderness, those 40 years in the desert, what did they need? They needed Emmanuel, God with them. God in the pillar of fire by night and the pillar of cloud by day. And as they came to the new land God gave them, and the nations around them were hostile to them, what did they need? They needed Emmanuel, God with them. And God came and dwelt with them in the tabernacle and then in the temple. God's people always had Emmanuel, God with them. They had no reason to fear even a great nation like Assyria. But Ahaz can't see that, because he fears Syria. He fears Israel more than he fears the one true God. And then, because he fears those two nations, he begins to love and trust Assyria in God's place. See, this is Ahaz's plan. Ahaz was a worshiper of idols, even in Israel, or Judah rather. There was the temple there, right? the worship of the one true God, but Ahaz insisted on worshiping other gods. And Ahaz's plan is to take his private worship of idols and make it into his foreign policy. So what Ahaz does, against the advice of Isaiah, is he abandons the Emmanuel plan and he goes to King Tilgath-Pileser III in Assyria. He sends messengers saying, "Oh, great King Tilgath-Pileser III, there's nobody more powerful than you. Would you please protect me from these two nations, Israel and Syria, that are attacking me?" So think about this. This is like one mouse going to the big hungry cat and saying, "Hey, cat, can you protect me from these other two mice?" I mean, what's going to happen here? What's going to happen after that cat gobbles up those two mice to the north, Israel and Syria? You think it's going to be done eating?
No.
It's a bad plan. But it seems like it would work. Now, if you go to 2 Kings chapter 16 or 2 Chronicles chapter 28, you can read in detail about how this all goes down. But what happened is Ahaz goes to, he sends messengers to Tilgath-Pileser III in Assyria, and he makes a treaty, he makes this negotiation. But in order to do that, he has to trade something. He actually takes gold out of the temple that was reserved for the worship of God, and he takes it and he trades it in to Tilgath-Pileser and says, "Here, take this and protect me." So do you see how the idolatry works here? Is that Ahaz has to take something, glory that belongs to God alone, and he trades it in to get the protection of this idol that he fears, loves, and trusts more than God. This is the way the worship of idols always works. When we fear, love, and trust in anything or anyone more than God, we end up trading something that belongs to God alone. In fact, it says in 2 Kings 16 that as Ahaz, he eventually goes to visit Tilgath-Pileser in Damascus. And he sees this altar, this pagan altar, and he loves it. He thinks it's so cool that he sends word back to the high priest and says, "Build something like this." And as Ahaz comes back, you see that the worship of the temple begins to be oriented, reoriented around idolatry and not the worship of the one true God. See, this is the way that the worship of idols works. We begin to fear, love, and trust in something more than God, and we begin to reorient our lives around it. We reorient our best affections around what we fear, love, and trust at the expense of fearing, loving, and trusting God alone. We begin to reorient our schedules around what we fear, love, and trust. I think that's why we miss worship sometimes, is because we're reorienting ourselves around what we fear, love, trust. We fear sitting the bench. We fear missing out on this experience. We love, we trust in other things. And so we end up trading something and reorienting our lives around what matters most to us. And we give our best affections to something that's not God. Now here's the thing about idolatry, is that idolatry actually works. It's very pragmatic. It works. It gets the job done. It's very expedient. Do you know what happened when Ahaz went to Tilgath-Pileser III with his offering from the temple? Guess what happened? He got exactly what he wanted. Tilgath-Pileser said, "Oh, thanks. Sure, of course. I would just love to take out Syria and Israel. In fact, I'll do that just right now." And so Tilgath-Pileser from Assyria crushed those two kingdoms that Ahaz feared. But did the king stop there? You see, idolatry works. When we fear, love, and trust in anything other than God, it actually works in the moment very often. It gives us a sense of pleasure. It gives us a sense of security. But then it blows up in our face. It devours us. Some years later, in 701 BC, the king of Assyria, now Sennacherib, would be right at the gates of Jerusalem, and Hezekiah, the son of Ahaz, would have to deal with this big, hungry cat who is now prowling at the gates of Jerusalem, ready to devour this nation that once made a treaty with him. That's the way idolatry works. It eventually turns and devours us. But even in the midst of our idolatry, even in the midst of our idols turning on us and devouring us, God sends to us Emmanuel, God with us. Let's look at verse 10. Now, in between verse 9 and verse 10, there might have been a very long interlude. Remember, Isaiah said to Ahaz, don't do the Assyria plan, trust God, Emmanuel, God's with us. In between verses 9 and 10, it may be that that's the time period where Ahaz went and sought the help of Assyria. But now Isaiah comes again in verse 10, and the Lord spoke to Ahaz, ask the Lord your God for a sign, whether in the deepest depths or in the highest heights. But Ahaz said, I will not ask. I will not put the Lord to the test. Do you think that Ahaz is saying this out of true fear, love, and trust for God, or out of his idolatry? Here's the crazy thing, is that he's actually quoting the Bible. He's saying a verse from Deuteronomy, a verse that Jesus even quotes as he is tempted by the devil in the wilderness. But the crazy thing about idolatry is that it can look very religious. It can say, oh, you know, I go to church and I read my Bible and I pray and I say these things. Yeah, God's first, but it's still got this stash of idols that it conceals underneath that nobody can see. See, Ahaz is in bed with his idolatry, and he doesn't want to get up. So he says this nice, pious statement to put off the sign that God would give. Verse 13, then Isaiah said, hear now, you house of David, is it not enough to try the patience of men? Will you try the patience of my God also? Therefore the Lord himself will give you a sign. So Isaiah says, you don't want a sign, Ahaz? Fine, God's going to still give you one. And it's not going to be what you expect. The virgin will be with child and will give birth to a son and will call him Emmanuel, which means God with us. We're back to plan A, right? Emmanuel, God with us. This is kind of a mysterious text because we know very little about this child. Sometimes prophecies are fulfilled immediately and then you get a greater fulfillment later, as we see in Matthew chapter 1, as Jesus is Emmanuel. But in this time period, in the 8th century B.C., there was a promised child, a young woman of marriageable age, presumably a virgin, was with child. And we don't know if this was Ahaz's son or if it was possibly Isaiah's son or an undisclosed person's son. But this child in some way would be a sign of God's presence with his people for their good, even in the midst of big hungry cats like Assyria. Emmanuel. God with us. Isn't it amazing that this sign that God gives looks really foolish, right? I've got this big problem, Assyria, and God gives a foolish sign, a baby. But this is God's wisdom that looks foolish to us, but it's the wisdom that breaks our foolishness and our idolatry into pieces. Ahaz and the nation has this huge problem, and God gives a sign that looks weak. What's weaker than a baby? But this is God's weakness that is stronger than our strength, that breaks our strength apart and shows it to be weakness. It's God's weakness that's actually strength that makes us strong. Emmanuel, God with us. Nearly 700 years later, God did send Emmanuel to his people, and he sent Emmanuel in a fuller and more complete way. In the past, God spoke to his people through the prophets, and Emmanuel was with his people in the temple, in the tabernacle. But in the right time, at the end of the age, God sent his son, Jesus Christ, Emmanuel, clothed in human flesh, not just in a temple or in a text. He sent the Word made flesh for you and for me to put an end to our idolatry. This is Emmanuel, God with us. His cross looks like foolishness to the world, but his cross is the wisdom that is truly wisdom from God. His cross looks like weakness, but it is the mighty power of God that destroys our idols. See, here's the thing that I want to drive home, that I want you to take home with you today, is this, is that our idols, whatever they might be, they eventually turn on us. Sometimes they leave us very wounded. But here's the thing about Emmanuel. It's that Emmanuel never turns on us. Our idols will turn on us. They will take the best from us and then give us the worst. But Emmanuel takes the worst that we have and gives us his best. Our idols leave us to die, but Jesus dies for us and remains with us, even when we work through the pain of our idols who have abandoned us. You see, Jesus takes the scratches and the clawing of that angry cat, our idols, whatever it might be, and he drop kicks that feline into hell. That's what Jesus does. Take this home with you, this, that Emmanuel has bound himself to you inseparably in body and in blood. Emmanuel has bound himself to you inseparably in your baptism. And he says, you are mine and I'm all that you need. Whatever you fear more than me, whatever you trust more than me, whatever you love more than me, I am what you need. Perhaps you've experienced your idols abandoning you. And if you haven't, you will someday. And when our idols abandon us, it's a moment of grace. It may be painful, but it's a moment of grace, because here's what God does. God takes away from us sometimes something that makes us happy in the moment, but he gives us something that will make us happy for eternity. Emmanuel, God with us. God will allow the idol to crumble in our hands so that we might fall apart into the hands, into the nail-scarred hands of Emmanuel. When our idols fail us, people of God, this is a moment of grace. It's a moment of grace where we return to the God who loves us. As we close today, think about the prodigal son. It's really a story of idolatry, right? He's at home with his father, and then he says, I don't want dad's rules. I'm out of here. He takes the money that his father allows him to have, and he goes on a long journey of idolatry. And you know what? Idolatry works. He had to trade something for it. He had to trade the love of his father to get the idolatry. And it worked in the moment. He had a lot of fun. He had friends. He had pleasurable experiences. But then what happens? The idol turns and devours him. And he finds himself face down in the mud. But for him, for that prodigal son, it was a moment of grace, right? It was a moment of grace because after losing everything, he still heard in his ears the voice of the father that called him home. And he went back to his father, and he didn't find an angry scowl. He didn't find rejection. He actually found a father who ran to him and embraced him and cleansed him from his idolatry with his own tears. People of God, today, as we approach the Lord's Supper in a few short moments, the Lord invites you to take out those hidden idols and to lay them down. Some of them that you lay down, you will lay down by God's grace for good, because they're not good for you. They will harm you rather than hurt you. Some of them you will lay down and they will be transformed by God, not into an idol, but into something to worship God with. Say perhaps that money is your idol, that thing you fear, love, and trust, that thing that keeps you up late at night. God would have you lay down the idol and then have it taken up again as a way to love God and to love your neighbor. Say it's your work that consumes everything, your every waking thought, your fearing and loving and trusting your work. God would have you lay that down and have you lay it aside only to take it up again as something you can use to worship him with and serve your neighbor with. But today, as we take the Lord's Supper, we lay down those idols and we come to the Lord's table with open hands. And you know what God gives you in those open hands? Emmanuel. In body and in blood, on your lips, he gives you Emmanuel. And that is where true and lasting happiness is found. To him be the glory, now and forever. Amen.